and sing and praise the whole day through. You said that I can win. You washed away my sins. And how precious you are, I praise you. And all that I have, He's given me, giving back to the world all that I cherish most, love, joy, and hope.
Praise You by the gospel singer Jim Miller. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson. This week we will be talking about military veterans in the Black Church in the Mississippi Delta with James Johnson, Jr., Reverend Freddie Johnson, and Reverend Roosevelt Johnson. Also, a live interview and in-studio performance by musician Stacy Robbins with Chuck Crow accompanying her on guitar. But right now, I'm on the line with Jamila. She will be performing at the upcoming celebration honoring Dr. Martin Luther King at the Exchange, located at 114 West 5th Street, downtown Los Angeles, Sunday, January the 15th, and Monday, January the 16th, 2012, at 2 o'clock p.m. How you doing, Jamila?
Oh, I'm doing good. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, just fine. Now, Jamila, can you tell us a little about what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. mean to you?
Wow. Well, you know, I was pondering that today, and it kept coming to my mind that Martin Luther King was a Baptist preacher, and he was born of a Baptist preacher, and the thing that struck me the most was that he was someone who wanted more than anything to live out his faith. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that struck me most about him, someone willing to go to the point of losing his life in order to save others' lives and to make other people's lives better.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us something? How do you talk to how old is Soul? About 8 or 9 or something like that?
Soul is 11 years old now.
Ooh, he's growing up. He's big now. Well, yes. How do you talk to Soul and other little young people about the meaning of Dr. King?
Well, you know, when we talk about it, and we've talked about it a lot, the thing that children always seem to have on their minds is simple things like, I wonder how it felt to die. Like, he'll say something like that. But they are very very much concerned about the world, and even though we may not think that they're noticing things, they notice a lot. Mm-hmm. And they see inequality and injustice sometimes long before an adult will, and they'll ask you those really pressing questions. But I always tell him that if there's something in your heart that you really believe that you are called to do, no matter what, do it, because that desire that's in your heart was put there by God. Mm-hmm. And I tell them that just as Martin Luther King had an ordained purpose created in him by God, so does he and every other child, that they're precious and that they are purposed, especially for something great, just as Martin Luther King was.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. You know, I get a lot of questions about when I be talking about Jim Miller. What is Jamila's last name? What do you tell people?
My last name is Majid.
Okay, beautiful, beautiful. Also, how about for people that want to get in contact with you about performing? What is your contact information?
Okay, they can visit me at JamilaMinistries.com, or they can also call at 310-991-5396. That's 310-991-5396. Or they can email me at JamilaSings@yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we're getting ready to hear one of your songs. Can you tell us a little about the song we're getting ready to hear?
I think the one you're going to play is called You Look Beyond My Faults and Saw My Need.
Yes.
This is one of the first songs that I heard sing at a time of my life when I was very, very far away from any peace and very, very far away from God.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard someone sing that song. And this song describes to me that no matter how far you have gone down, no matter where you've been or no matter what you've done, that there is a someone, and that someone is Jesus, who will look beyond each and every fault and meet you at the place of your need and be your best friend,
mm-hmm,
throughout each and every problem or trial in life. And this song really has proven to be just that for me, you know, as I walk in my journey, that there's always my best friend, my Savior and Lord Jesus, who's waiting and willing to listen and be everything and all that it is that I need,
mm-hmm,
in this life.
Okay. All right. So let's enjoy Jamila performing He Looked Beyond My Faults. Jamila. Hey, thank you, Jamila, performing He Looked Beyond My Faults and Saw All My Needs. Now, on Monday, December the 26th, 2011, I did an interview in Greenville, Mississippi with James Johnson, Jr. He's a Vietnam veteran, and we talked about the needs of veterans in the Mississippi Delta and throughout the nation, and the problem they face coming back from these war zones. I'm sitting here with James Johnson, Jr.
Tell us first about your military experience. When were you in the military? What branch you was in?
June 1965 to June 1967.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. Army.
Mm-hmm. You was in Vietnam?
1966.
Yeah, can you tell us a little about that? What was it like for? I've always heard during that particular time that the average age of the soldiers during that time was about 19. Yeah.
20.
Yeah. Can you tell us what it was like about being in Vietnam during that time?
Well, at first, when we first went to Vietnam, we really wasn't prepared to go to Vietnam. Half of us didn't even know what Vietnam was until we got over there. They were shooting at us as we got off the plane in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself, for guys that had never been shot at before, but I had never even, before I went into service, I had never even touched a gun. But after being there for a while, you know, you either get used to it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And we got used to it, and we got in very few firefights because Charlie was always running from us, you know. It wasn't conventional warfare. But there were times when they did ambushes. And mm-hmm. I've seen guys get their head blown off, eyes blown out,
mm-hmm.
and didn't traumatize us at the time. But later on, the trauma began to show in the soldiers, you know, especially when they came back to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got back here, Vietnam was a real unpopular war. You know, they actually blamed the soldiers for the war over there. We didn't start the war. You know, most of the guys, the majority of the guys was drafted. You know, very few guys volunteered to go to Vietnam. But as the war went on, because I was just over there 13 months, long enough. But the guys that came behind me, they really caught hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's when Charlie really started to fight back. You know, our army was so much superior to theirs, weapon-wise. But as guerrilla fighters, we were no match for them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of guys got killed. A lot of men got killed.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of stuff going on that really shouldn't have been going on, you know, on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But war is war.
Mm-hmm. Was this during the time of Lieutenant Calley also?
I believe that was after me.
Mm-hmm.
That happened after I had left Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. When they slaughtered like 1,300 civilians.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it happened after I left Vietnam.
What was the racial situation among the soldiers?
American soldiers?
Yeah.
It was fine, as long as we was over there fighting together. All changed when we got back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, same guys that you were sleeping with, calling your buddy. When they got back here, they just changed. You know, this was the white, between the whites and the black. Of course, that was back in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
you know. And things changed when we got back to the States. You know, guys like it, they didn't even know you. The same mm-hmm. guy you even spent a year in the foxhole with.
Mm-hmm.
But you get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if you're used to that anyway.
Mm-hmm. How about did the soldiers know what was happening with Agent Orange at that particular time?
No idea. Mm-hmm. None whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Never even heard of it. All we knew is that they were spraying some kind of foliage to kill the vegetation. So that's what they were telling us. Mm-hmm. But after they sprayed it, then we had to go through it mm-hmm. and look for looking for Charlie. But we didn't have no idea that this stuff was as deadly as it was.
Mm-hmm. And now they're finding out that a few years ago that the symptoms and stuff showing up.
They haven't even scratched the surface of mm-hmm. as to what that stuff called. A lot mm-hmm. of guys suffer from things, and the military refused to make it service connected. Mm-hmm. You know, they just every 4 or 5 years they add 3 or 4 things to that list. Mm-hmm. You know, they added about 5 things to the list this year alone. Mm-hmm. Ischemic heart disease. I can't name. I'd have to have my pamphlet name. Mm-hmm. You know,
but it's all related to that aging or it's a symptom. Right. Of that. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that's happening in the Iraqi-Afghanistan war that's different from the Vietnam War is the fact the Vietnam War was dealing with jungle warfare.
That's right.
And whereas, especially in Iraq, they're dealing with urban warfare. Do you think that make a difference? Which one you consider to be the most difficult in terms of these soldiers adjusting to?
The one that's coming back now. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It's been more difficult for them because, well, you see, in the jungle, when you're in the jungle, you got cover. You know, but the water they was fighting, it was, you know, roadside bombs and that's a whole array of things that the army couldn't prepare you for. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't really prepare us for Vietnam, but we had some kind of idea of what kind of war we was going to be fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to hunt Charlie down. Mm-hmm. And then when we did finally catch up with him, like I said, our firepower was so much superior to theirs. We very seldom got in firefights because Charlie was always trying to dodge us or stay out of our way. And they had some crude methods like punches, stakes, and snakes in caves. And see, that was like that kind of war was like medieval. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Compared to this war now.
Mm-hmm. But effective.
That's right. It was, mm-hmm. yeah, it was effective for them. They're the best guerrilla fighters in the world. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever beat them.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you mm-hmm. this. A lot of veterans is coming back, a lot of Vietnam veterans right now, where they recognize the concept of PTSD. And what's the situation with that now? Let me put it another way. For such a long time, they didn't recognize PTSD as it relates to the Vietnam veterans. They just began to recognize this now, right? What do you think in relationship to the ones coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq in relationship to PTSD? What kind of advice that you would give them in terms of dealing with this? Or what kind of comments would you have on that?
Well, I think that, you know, I stated before that the soldiers need to be debriefed, and I don't mean for no 2 or 3 weeks. I'm talking about 6, 7 months, maybe even a year before they let them back out into society. Because you don't just go into a war, and when you leave, you turn it off. It don't go like that. You know, that's when a lot of families, guys can't keep families. They can't keep jobs. Then they turn to the only thing they know is violence. But the Army don't take enough time out to try to debrief these guys, you know. Mm-hmm. You have some kind of, what would you call it? When they take these guys and try to work with them to get their mindset back to normal. Mm-hmm. Which has never happened. You know, they never get back to normal anyway. Mm-hmm. But you can, if a guy know what his problem is, then he can try to deal with it. A lot of veterans don't even know they have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it
mm-hmm.
for years. I didn't know what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cost me my first family.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, James Johnson Jr. Next is a short interview I did with Reverend Freddie Johnson. He is a minister and also a Vietnam veteran from the Air Force. I'm here with Reverend Freddie Johnson.
I'm here with Reverend Freddie Johnson, and I'm going to start off. First, tell us a little about your ministry and what you try to achieve with your ministry.
Well, the ministry right now is going good. I really like to achieve more souls for Jesus. And my ministry is not on a solid foundation right now. I have been made an offer to go back to Seattle, Washington. You know, I reside in Memphis, Tennessee. Go back to Seattle, Washington, and go back to the pastor that really my father in the ministry. And I talked to him a couple days ago, and he wanted me to come back and, well, the church isn't doing that well.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to do a revival sometime right after the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't set it up yet.
Tell me this. When did you get involved in the ministry? When were you ordained?
I was ordained in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Preached my first sermon at you was there.
I got the sermon.
Greater Trinity Missionary Baptist Church. Paul Stoop was pastor. Is the pastor.
What year?
Mm-hmm. It was in 1997. Mm-hmm. No, that was in 95.
Mm-hmm.
95.
Mm-hmm.
The same year I got married in.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. Because we talked a little bit earlier. Can you tell us a little about your military experience? When were you in the military? What branch that you was in? Mm-hmm. Where you traveled to? Like that.
Well, I'm a stud right here. At the age of 17, I came out of high school. You know, diploma. And I always did want to go in the military. And I always did want to be a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mom, Mrs. Hattie Johnson, and Dad had signed for me to get in the Air Force, which they did at the age of 17. And from there, I went to Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. And from there, after I did my basic training, I was sent to Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. And I stayed there about 2 years. Yeah, about around 2 years. And I got on the bus. Let me tell you how I got out of Florida now,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't figure was right because I got on the basketball team and during one of the games, I got to fight with one of them captains. It's gospel truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I knew, I had orders for Korea. I'm saying that's gospel. That's how I wound up in Korea,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of, to me, like a prejudice.
Racial move.
Racial move, yeah. Within the military.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? When I got to Korea, and which I do, still do until this day, I consider that as one of the best tools that I had while I was in the service.
Mm-hmm.
And what, don't let me leave this out. I wasn't but 20 years old
mm-hmm.
when I was in Korea.
And what was your MOS? What was your
Air Police.
Mm-hmm.
Like I told you, I always wanted to be a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
When I went in the Air Force, my MOS, my choice, my how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
I chose to be an Air Police, and they gave me the test.
Mm-hmm.
I say it like that.
I
passed the test,
mm-hmm.
and they sent me to basic training. Then I went to Air Police School.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
What years was this?
Oh, it was in 64. That's when I first went into service.
Mm-hmm.
1964.
And you came out what year?
69.
69.
Discharged from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went in, I intended to make Air Force a career out of the Air Force.
Now, let me ask you all of this. One of the things that's happening today is so many veterans that come out, that, especially, well, we know about the Vietnam veterans. So many of them end up homeless, dealing with their issues and their ghosts and stuff like that. But also, the recent wars like Afghanistan and Iraq, also a lot of veterans coming out having a hard time adjusting. And a lot of them end up homeless and stuff like that. You know, you as a minister, do you see any way that these veterans can be helped to help solve, to help these veterans adjust back to the community, to the society? Can the ministry play a part of that? Do they have an obligation also?
The church plays an important role in every community. And for the veterans, the homeless veterans, the disabled veterans is concerned, the reason some of the veterans don't get their benefits is because they don't apply for them. And some of them do apply and are denied. And I happen to fit in that category. In 86, I applied for Social Security disability. Because, simply because I had been denied by the VA and for service-connected PTSD. It wasn't PTSD at that time. At that time, it really hadn't been researched, you know, PTSD. Nobody knew what it was or nothing like that. So they diagnosed me with severe depression and start, put me on Social Security, getting a little check every month and all that kind of stuff. Because that I didn't give up and I did apply, I was able to do that. But simply because some of the veterans, they do not apply because they don't know how to. They don't know where to go, and they are really sick. You know, for Vietnam, any war, you know, that you have been in a stressful situation, such as firefights, you know, motor crews and all that kind of stuff, that mess with your mind. And when you come out to service and discharge and just throw back in the community, what can you do?
I know.
Let me ask this. Good point that you bring. Okay, is it the church have an we know the church have an obligation to
everybody to
make this kind of information a part of their ministry, a part of the church, even if it's just booklets or little newsletters and stuff? Because what I find out exactly what you're talking about. All of these resources that's available to veterans, and a lot of times when you talk to veterans, especially homeless veterans, and they'd be surprised that these resources are available to them. What can a good church, how can they address this? How can they, even if it's just veterans in their church congregation, how can they make it a part of their ministry so the veterans in their congregation can get this kind of information?
Look, I could always speak out of experience with that question. What we did when we was in Seattle at Freedom Church, we took Veterans Day. And we focused on all the veterans, the ones that was coming to the church and the one that had joined the church and the one that we had evangelized. Couldn't get them to come. We focused on, you know, because we set out a wave. Because we had hundreds and hundreds. I was director of the 100 Men's Ministry. So we had men assigned to get, you know, it was just one day, which wasn't enough. I'm not going to say we did our job for trying to reach those veterans, but the church has got to start reaching those veterans. Because the church is the pillar of any community. No matter how big, how many members or congregation Mm-hmm. The church has got to start trying to reach those veterans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Reverend Freddie Johnson. Now, at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Miss Earlene Anthony for our community calendar.
This is the community calendar for January, Thursday, January the 12th, starting at 7 p.m. Drama Stage Kuhn will participate in the Arts Walk, which will be honoring Dr. King with open mic and sounding off, featuring musical guest Victor Allen and guitarist Jack Rivera. The featured poets are Michelle Autry, Dr. Mungo, Twin, and Carmen Vega. It will be hosted by Andrea and Jamal. Sign up for the open mic is at 6:30 p.m. Location, The Exchange, 114 West 5th Street. For more information or to participate, you can call 323-850-4436. And on Friday, January the 13th, this is at 10:30 a.m. Drama Stage Qumran has a program set up called DCOP, Drama Stage Community Outreach Program. And along with the supporters of several other organizations, we'll be distributing socks and caps to the residents of Skid Row. The location of this event will be the Central City Church of the Nazarene, corner of 6th and San Pedro. And for more information, you can contact 323-850-4436. Another upcoming two-day event, this will be Sunday, January the 15th and Monday, January the 16th. On Sunday, Drama Stage Qumran will be honoring Dr. King by performing a dramatic reading of I Have a Dream speech and excerpts from the letter from the Birmingham jail. Special musical guest will be gospel singer Jamila. And on Monday, January the 16th at 2 p.m., Drama Stage Qumran will honor Dr. King by performing a dramatic reading of I Have a Dream speech and excerpts from the letter from the Birmingham jail. Our special musical guest will be gospel singer Jamila. Also, we'll have a special guest panel. We'll be discussing Dr. King's views on nonviolence. This will be followed by a Q&A session. The location of this event will be The Exchange, 114 West 5th Street. This is a free event and all are welcome to attend. For more information, you can contact 323-850-4436. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com. Attention, Earlene Anthony. And once again, our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. Our last interview from the Mississippi Delta is with Reverend Roosevelt Johnson. We talked about military veterans, the homeless, and the black church. I'm talking to Reverend Roosevelt Johnson.
He's the pastor of the Evergreen Baptist Church here in Greenville, Mississippi, my hometown. How you doing, Reverend Johnson?
Brother Ishmael, I'm fine. And you?
Oh, just fine. Look, first, tell us a little about your ministry here in Greenville. How long you been in the ministry? What your church tried to accomplish here in Greenville?
Well, I've been in the ministry ever since 1980 up until this point. I believe that would give us about 31 years. Mm-hmm. And I began my pastorate there at Evergreen in 1994 up until this present point.
Mm-hmm.
Our ministry is kind of unique ministry. We're not the traditional type ministry. We come in, we worship, and we go home, and we hire on outreach. We've already always had an outreach. I remember in the seminary, the question was asked, if your ministry move out of the community, what effect would it have on the community? So we have always tried to have a ministry that if we moved out, that it would leave a hurting effect on the
community, because we have outreach such as clothing giveaway that we've been doing over the past 10 years. Periodically, we give away food. We just believe in coming outside of the walls, trying to reach and help the hurting and the lost people that is around in the community.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we do with the drama stage Qumran up in Los Angeles also is we got a program called DCOP, which is Drama Stage Community Outreach Program. And we pass out hygiene kits and clothes with the goal of networking community members with the homeless, so they have a chance to talk to them, assess their needs, and all that kind of stuff. Now, let me ask you this also. What's the situation with the homeless here in Greenville, Mississippi?
Well, here in Greenville, and probably throughout the whole United States, homeless have different faces that they have in time past. When you think about a homeless person, you thought about a person that probably had dirty clothes, that probably had some kind of mental disability or such. But nowadays, you have people that had good jobs, and jobs has moved out for different reasons and has lost their home, you know, the home crisis that we've had. So homeless has a different phase than yesteryears. So there are many homeless people right here in Greenville. Although we're a city with approximately 50,000 plus people, you know, the less people, probably the less problem. But we have homeless here. We see an increase in homeless people. Day by day, you go to the store, you see somebody standing out, you know, asking for assistance, and you have to be moved by the spirit, whether you're going to help or whether this person is playing some type prank or just trying to get something for nothing. But yes, homeless is a crisis here, and right here in the Delta, in Greenville, Mississippi.
If you would estimate it, now back in Los Angeles, at any given time, on any given night in the county of Los Angeles, it's from 80 to 100,000 homeless people that sleep in the streets. How many in relationship to Greenville, Mississippi, would you estimate?
Well, to give you an accurate answer to that, I can only tell you what I have seen, or those that I have come in contact with. And looking at it from that angle, I said 50 to 100 that I know that are homeless right here in Greenville on the street that I've come in contact with. But I'm for sure it's many, many more. But you can't be everywhere at the same time. But those that I've come in contact with, 100 plus, 50 to 100 plus.
Okay. Now, let's get into the, because I know one aspect of the homeless situation is veterans who end up homeless for a number of reasons and all that kind of stuff. First of all, I know you're a military veteran also. Can you tell us a little about your military experience, when you was in, what branch you was in, et cetera, like that?
In 1971, I was drafted into the military. Now it's all volunteer army. Back then, you received a notice in the mail saying Uncle Sam want you. And that's what I received while I was living in Detroit, Michigan. So I had to come back to Mississippi and go where I had registered. And I ended up coming back to Mississippi, going to Fort Polk, Louisiana. And I was among the last of the draftees. I never will forget it. They took our pictures at the reception station. Which, what am I saying? After I got drafted, they cut the draft out, and it went into an all-volunteer military service. And being drafted in that particular time, I went to the military. I really went to the military to try to escape segregation. But I found out that once I entered the military, that segregation was right there, a part of the military, just like in civilian life.
Mm-hmm. Same kind of segregation that you had found in Mississippi at that time.
Yeah, well, we was in the root of segregation. Back in that time, you had colored water fountain, you had white water fountain, you had colored restroom, you had white restroom, mm-hmm. and it was legal throughout the land. Mm-hmm. I can recall the time when Afro-American police officer could not arrest a white man. Mm-hmm. Would have to call for a white man to come and make the arrest, and 9 times out of 10, when the white man came, he allowed the other white person to go
mm-hmm.
without being punished for whatever they may have done.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. We talked a little earlier about a large portion of the homeless population. We find veterans that end up homeless. What is the main reason, the major reason of these veterans that end up homeless?
Well, I'm glad that they have started to look at veterans from a point of view that everybody that is in a war zone or have been over in a war zone, especially participating in a war zone, that it plays a long-term effect on their life.
Mm-hmm.
Post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
Years back, they wasn't looking into that. They would call you in, let you serve your time, and then just discharge you right back out into civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
And a change has to take place. By mm-hmm. me being a veteran, I had to experience that change. And mm-hmm. I had to adapt to that change after I was discharged. For example, while you're in the military, you're trained to protect yourself and kill the enemy. You're trained to love your weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You're trained to discharge your firearm. But once you release from the military, then the law, civilian laws are different. You're not even allowed to carry a firearm. So mm-hmm. there's just some of the changes that mm-hmm. take place. And the main thing, being traumatized,
mm-hmm.
to watch a buddy fall in battle, to watch anybody die in front of you, takes a long-term effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
And at any time, although you can surface and try to hold it down, but mm-hmm. at any time, this stuff can surface back up
mm-hmm.
and cause you to react or do something you wouldn't normally do.
Mm-hmm.
But most time, it's either mental or post-traumatic stress or something that you have went through that traumatized you and you never dealt with it. And instead of getting better, it's getting worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here you are, have served your country, and now you're in civilian life, and you're not capable of really managing your things or accomplishing your goals. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's why a lot of the vets find themselves out on the street and homeless.
Mm-hmm.
They have nobody to actually guide them and help them make that transition back into civilian life.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. One of the things that we've been trying to push in Los Angeles in relationship to the homeless, because we believe that the religious community have a responsibility to the homeless population. So what we've been trying to push, especially in relationship to all of the, in Los Angeles have a lot of empty houses because of the foreclosure thing. And we've been trying to push the religious organization, the Christians, the Muslims, and the Jews, the Jewish organization, to go out and either buy some of this property or rent some of this property and move some of these homeless people in and start programs, start trying to develop some programs and try to reintegrate them into their community. Do you think something like that is possible down here in Greenville too?
Yeah, it's possible from the that point of view, from the religious point of view, but I just believe that it also can be a city or state issue
mm-hmm.
because yes, we have a lot of foreclosure and dilapidated houses right here in Greenville, just sitting down, rotting away, and over a number of years, it belongs to the city or it belongs to the state. And before they give it to somebody, they come and tear it down, use demolition to tear it down, and just left with an empty lot. But the majority of the time, the house just sit, and it become an eyesore. One thing in the Afro-America community in the South Delta, there has been a loss of hope. We can walk outside and look in our community. We don't have anything to encourage us that we can do better than what we're doing. Because as we look throughout our community, instead of the community improving, it's beginning to go down.
Mm-hmm.
So that loss of hope is there. But it would be great if we could, you might not, from a religious point of view, because various size of congregation
mm-hmm.
and types of membership that may belong to a per se congregation, mm-hmm. you might not can take 15 or 20 houses, renovate them, and give them to the homeless, but surely we could take one
mm-hmm.
and renovate it.
Mm-hmm.
And put a homeless person in there, and if that when that homeless person get in there, they would feel ownership. Mm-hmm. Now you wouldn't have to tell them to keep up their property. I'm for sure they'll show love in that property and keep it up, mm-hmm. and that'll bring the community back like it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
So sure, that would be a good thing.
Now let me close out with just a couple more questions. I want to ask you. From a scriptorial point of view, what is the responsibility of the church, of the ministry, to the homeless? Is there anything, you know, is there a scriptorial that deals with the homeless, the obligations
yeah.
of the church and the Christian community, the religious
sure.
community to the homeless?
Yeah. A scripture that come off the top of my head is the 25th chapter of Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
When there's going to be a great separation of the sheep and the goat. And our relationship with man has a lot to do with our relationship with God. And in that 25th chapter of Matthew, the question was asked, said, I was hungry and you fed me not.
Mm-hmm.
I was naked and you didn't clothe me. I was in prison, and you didn't come see me. And the question was asked, when did we do all this thing, Lord? Those that did it. And then the response was, that which you have done unto the least, you've done it also unto me.
Mm-hmm.
So scriptural point of view, anybody that is religious, in order to be religious and love God, you got to love people. So whatever we do to the less fortunate, we're doing it also unto God, according mm-hmm. to the scripture. So if we see a person in need, it is our scriptural duty is to try to assist that person in mm-hmm. any way that we can.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. And this is Reverend Roosevelt Johnson. He's the pastor of the Evergreen Baptist Church here in Greenville, Mississippi, and he's also my brother. Thank you very much.
God bless.
Yeah. Great interview.
Not yet. Thank you, Reverend Roosevelt Johnson. Our last section for tonight is from the Voices from the Ether portion of the show.
About 15 minutes to 9, then you're listening to Voices from the Ether. Playing in the background is my in-studio guest, Miss Stacy Robbins. She is here to perform for us live with Chuck Crow, accompanying her on guitar, who is a fabulous artist in his own right. Welcome, Stacy and Chuck. I found it really hard to get past the second song on your CD, Without Tears. Your music is very moving. What is the inspiration for Nothing's Free?
Well, there's a message in it, aside from the personal struggles I was going through at the time. Part of it is that I sort of feel like if you're going to go through loss, you have to go through it with integrity, because you have to understand your worth. And so the sort of the feeling behind Nothing's Free is about letting go and accepting loss, or accepting what is, but knowing your worth and not maintaining your integrity through that, because you have to know that everything is a choice.
Yes, and I didn't understand why the emotional buildup when I was listening to it until this morning, when I was on the phone with the VA for hours and hours and hours, and they finally came back. One of the recorded messages was that the price of freedom is not free, and my 8 years in the military cost me dearly, and I'm suffering from it today. So, Chuck, can you kind of like give us a little strumming in the back, a little light thing going on back there while I ask a few more questions here? So you came to Los Angeles in 1987 from Indiana.
Yeah.
And as many artists do, did you come here with dreams of stardom and success?
I actually came to go to graduate school. So yes and no. I've always been a musician at heart. And so it was a wonderful place to sort of connect with really fabulous musicians. And I don't know that fame and stardom was really at the crux of it.
I see. Okay. I know from seeing a lot of homeless people on the street, a lot of homeless talent on the street and in the subways and the trains. I know that most people come to L.A. and crash and burn because they had no other careers to sustain them. But I understand that's not so in your case. Besides the music, what do you do for a living?
Well, like I said, I came here to go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. I actually ended up coming out to Riverside to grow corn. I came from Indiana, a plant biochemist, and one of our collaborators was in Riverside. So I came out to help him learn how to grow experimental fields of corn, and he pretty much listened to nothing I had to say. So it was all very much worthwhile. And but that's okay. My story had a great next chapter, and I ended up in Los Angeles working at UCLA. And I'm still in medical research today.
Mm-hmm. I have a stack of your CDs here. And I love the design and the tapestry work on them.
Can you
tell me something a little bit about the imaginary friends? Where did that come from?
It actually started a little bit as a joke, because I did actually have imaginary friends as a child.
Okay.
and I think it was my mom that, you know, embarrassed me in front of some of my musician friends, telling stories about the, you know, times I'd make her set extra places at the table and, you know, and things like that. So when we were looking for a band name, they suggested Stacey Robin and her imaginary friends, and it eventually became Imaginary Friends from there.
Yeah, my thing were those little trolls.
I had a monkey and a tiger.
Okay.
Why
okay.
a monkey and a tiger, I don't know, but that's what I had.
Okay. Tigger 2.
Wow.
Earlene, I think you have a question for a guest.
Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Earlene.
Briefly tell us about the Spirited Woman movement with Massive Meals that you are part of. A wonderful friend, Nancy Mills.
She is wonderful. Yeah, she's been a great friend and a great inspiration to me. I've actually met some of the most amazing, as she calls them, visionary women, people making a difference, people that really have helped me look at the world in a different way. And I've really enjoyed being a part of that community.
Great. And as you can hear, we have Chuck playing in the background. He has a great CD here that I haven't listened to, but I love the title, Another Nevermore. It's about that time. We're going to have some musicians play live with real music, with real instruments. No synthesizers, no drum machines or anything like that. So I'm going to give Stacey a moment or two to go ahead and set up and take those headphones off.
Okay.
And they're going to play two songs for us tonight. One is going to be called Follow, and the other is Pride. Prepare yourself, ladies and gentlemen, for quite an experience.
Thank you. So this song is called Follow. It's on the compilation CD, the Spirited Woman compilation CD, which is, it's drawn from my various works. Sort of put together some of the more message-oriented songs. And this is from my solo CD, Stacey Robin, Some Kind of Bird.
More to go, I think.
Mm-hmm, sure.
They're getting there.
Yeah, the song is called Pride. It's on the Drawing Down the Moon CD and also, of course, on the Spirited Woman compilation CD. And it is about, you know,
pride.
Once again, pride, keeping your, yeah, you know, one of those things about integrity and just moving forward, so.
stand, me, myself, and I. Come a long, long way, let's try. In my life, didn't stand for what was mine, and what I had, I forgot my pride. My pride, people come.
Very much. Okay, we have a show coming up. It's going to be at the Room 5 Lounge upstairs, Saturday, January the 14th. Stacy and her imaginary friends will be performing at 7 p.m. And it's going to be at the, how do you pronounce this?
Amalfi.
Amalfi Restaurant and Bar, located at 143 North La Brea Avenue. And let's see here. Where can people get your CDs, more information about your performances? Yeah, grab that microphone. There you go.
You can find us pretty much anywhere, Amazon, iTunes, Stacy Robin, like the bird, .com, imaginaryfriends.net.
CD Baby, I think.
So, yeah, you can find us CD Baby, iTunes, Amazon, pretty much. You know, you can Google anything nowadays, right?
That's
as long
correct.
As you can spell it, you can Google it.
You can find it. And, Chuck, another Nevermore. We have to get you back in one day to play. How about your music besides www.chuckcrow.com?
Yes, chuckcrow.com with the silent E, just like Russell Crowe.
Okay.
And you can find me on CD Baby and Amazon, iTunes, all those places as well.
And we do play as Robin and Crow, which,
That's good. It's just like imaginary friends. It turns out to be if, you know. Okay. So this concludes Voices from the Ether portion of the show. Now back to our host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson.
Okay. Thank you, Tyrone. Excellent music. Now, I would like to extend a special thanks to James Johnson Jr., Reverend Freddie Johnson, and Reverend Roosevelt Johnson of Greenville, Mississippi, our in-studio guests, Stacy Robin, Chuck Crow on guitar, and on the line with the gospel singer Jamila. A special thanks to Jeremy and the Skid Row Studios, and a shout-out to my brother Robert Johnson and his family in Detroit, Michigan, to Tanisha and Lil Madison. Now, you can check out our shows or the Qumran Reports on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, skidrow.la, or www.dramastage-qumran.org. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report, and I leave you with the song that opens the show, I Praise You by Jamila.
Away my sins, and how precious you are. I praise you. Cherish most love, joy, and hope.